destruction to function. Justice for the human family, we demand it. Just us, truth, freedom, equality, a must us. Decolonization of the planet, so bust this. People be the power, now we build the justice. Pouring at system divinations, how we build the justice. Welcome the planet to the podcast, build the justice. Build the justice, build the justice, build. Is to add on or do away with justice.
Welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. I'm Monica Tuchka, a political science professor at Sac State, and my guest for today is Dr. Flo John Cofer, who many of you know as Dr. Flo. Dr. Flo is an epidemiologist with a PhD from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Currently, Dr. Flo is a senior director of policy at Public Health Advocates. Dr. Flo is a longtime local activist in Sacramento who recently announced that she's running for the mayor of the city. So hello, Dr. Flo. Thank you for coming on the Building Justice podcast.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I am so excited to just have a conversation with you and to be together with you for a little bit of time. How about we begin with a question about your relationship to political participation or local activism? You know, all of us live in political communities, but we're not all actively involved. So what brought you to participate actively? What keeps you going? And what do you think discourages so many Sacramentans from being local activists or just participating more in politics at the local level?
It's a great question, you know, and I think part of it is being able to tell a little bit of my story. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I am the daughter of two public school teachers. My mom taught eighth grade English. My dad taught eighth grade math, and they never met, you know, an issue in Sacramento that in Pittsburgh that they didn't want to be involved in. Whether that was, you know, what was going on in our neighborhood, in, you know, our faith community, whatever was happening, my parents were showing up and dragging me along to meetings and being involved in what was happening. I was also always dragged along when they went to vote. And unfortunately, when I was 11, my dad passed away from congestive heart failure. And so really what got me engaged in thinking about policy was actually reflecting on that experience later as I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. When my dad passed away, he was 47 and he had been smoking a good portion of his life. And that was before the tobacco companies were honest with us about the impact that smoking has on our health. They used to tell us it was health promoting. He also worked in the steel mills with my grandfather before he went to college to become a teacher. And so was exposed to all kinds of occupational hazards and, you know, and certainly, you know, things that would have been in the air that he would have inhaled as well. And he also worked in buildings with disturbed asbestos. And so all of those things came together to be able to shorten the number of years that we had together. And those were all opportunities for policy protections that now exist for him to have been protected in a way that would have allowed him to have more years in his life and more life in his years. And so I think about that, but I also think about the ways in which I was protected by policy. So during this really traumatic event where my father has passed away and I'm not yet 12, I also had the benefit of having individual and group grief counseling at my public school. And my mother was able to continue to afford our home on a teacher's salary. And so I was not taken away from the only community I knew. It was already a really destabilizing and disrupting and traumatic event in my life. And so when I went off to college, I was kind of looking for, you know, what is this bridge? How do I provide connection to communities? Because I started noticing patterns. My mom was reviewing scholarship applications for students. And I started realizing that too many of the students who were Black and Latino had stories of having already lost a parent when they were applying to college as part of their college application or their scholarship application process. And that means that these parents, right, presumably didn't make it to be 50. And so what does that mean when I'm looking at the life expectancy? And so that's how I got into public health. And that's how I got into, wow, there are opportunities for us to be able to shape what we know and take that and shape it into what we do. And so that's really how I got involved in policy, because I saw the opportunity. I saw what happened when protections didn't exist. And I saw what could happen when they did exist. And my life was the intersection of the best and the worst of that. So absolutely understand when people say, why would I bother to get involved? This all seems completely corrupt and misguided and nothing ever seems to change. But what I'm encouraged by is not looking at the immediate term of things, but looking long term. Because, you know, again, my father was born at a time where, you know, tobacco could be sold and everybody thought it was okay. And now we have so many protections that exist because people fought for that to happen.
Two things that really came to mind when you were speaking. The first was how important involvement at a young age through your family and through your community can be to sustain political engagement moving forward.
Absolutely.
And there are those families where people are politically active, and then there are families who aren't, and how do you engage them in the process is just a kind of question that came to mm-hmm. mind. And the second thing that I really thought about was this phrase that you had about being protected by policy. You know, we live in a time where people fly flags that say, don't tread on me. And they think that policy is not protective or disempowering or harmful. Mm-hmm. And here you're really flipping the script and telling us that if not for an active government and a community that is creating these policies, we are less secure, less free, less equal. Do you want to say a little bit more about that before we move on to another question?
Absolutely. So first, I would say, you know, I think this is the importance of history not being taught as a series of just, you know, dates and figures, but actually stories of people's lives. Because when I look at the arc of, you know, the experience, especially experience for me as a Black woman in the United States, and I think about all the Black women in my lineage that come before me, the story of policy is incredibly important. When I think about, you know, 1852 and, you know, the United States trying to decide if they're going to balance slave versus free states, right? The decision to not, that's not going to be progressive policy is a policy decision. When I think about the right to vote and women's suffrage, when I think about the civil rights movement and the right to not have separate but equal be the law of the land, right? All of these were policy decisions. When I even think about don't ask, don't tell, which during my lifetime was considered to be progressive policy. It's like, hey, we won't ask any questions. You don't tell us anything and everything is good. And now we have marriage equality. So when I think about this and also, of course, Roe v. Wade, right, which is, of course, before I was born, but all of these things were policy decisions and they meaningfully shaped what people's lives look like. And so that's incredibly important to me when as a student of history, I understand that these are not trivial decisions that we're making. These are major decisions about how we're going to live and where we're going to live. And they have major impact for generations to come. You also mentioned something really critical, I think, about people feeling demoralized and not getting involved or not maybe coming from a family where people were actively engaged in policy. And certainly that's the case for many people. You know, even if it's just a matter of voting and not really being engaged otherwise or not finding a way. And I think there also is a responsibility on our government to reach out and touch people, to invite them in. And one of the things that has been most frustrating to me, especially in the city of Sacramento and the county of Sacramento, is that it has felt very much like the system is designed and systems are perfectly designed to get the outcomes they do. And so it feels like the system is designed to make it so that it's difficult to follow what's going on, that your input is not really wanted, right? There are ways that we explicitly and implicitly convey our feelings about something, and giving people 2 minutes, you know, 5 days after they learn about something to provide public comment on an issue doesn't signal to anybody that you really want to have their input. And so I think there's a lot that we can do. As I think there's a responsibility of government to actually show up, especially at the local level where you are so close to people, to also invite people in and not make it so that only the people who come from a legacy of doing this work or whose jobs allow them to do it in a paid capacity are the ones who are involved, but really reaching out and making a space.
You're talking about political engagement, political engagement, political engagement, which is wonderful. And I know that you do a lot of professional advocacy work, like you were saying, with public health advocates. You've served on government commissions and committees. You've participated in direct action. You're talking about voting. If somebody is new to politics in the U.S. or new to politics in Sacramento, can you talk about what are the strengths and weaknesses of these different forms of political participation in terms of what impact they have or what benefits they give to the participant? Mm-hmm. Or how would you evaluate all these different forms if somebody was new to engagement and kind of wanted to have a scorecard.
What I would say is that there is no wrong entry to your political engagement. And I differ from, you know, many of, especially my professional colleagues, but also maybe even some of my, you know, friends and colleagues who are doing this work, you know, on a more volunteer and community level basis, because I see value in it all. And I don't think that there's actually a hierarchy of effectiveness. I think we all rely on every other aspect of how we engage in our communities. And so the way that I describe it to people is I say, you know, the folks who are doing direct action and mutual aid really are the ones who are kind of our moral compass. They're the ones saying, I'm not waiting for anybody else to do something. I'm going to do something, and I'm going to show you that it's possible. And I'm also going to push you and make noise and say, this is a major issue. And here's the North Star that we're focusing on. And then I think when the professional advocates come in and you're pushing and you're advocating towards your government to be able to change something, they're the translators. They're the ones who are saying, you see folks outside protesting in the streets, or you see people not even bothering to engage in this process and just doing mutual aid and other things. That should be your job. What are you going to do so that people on their own are not outpacing you when you're the one who has our budget? You're the one who has the institutional power, and this is your responsibility. And so they're translating that message. And then our elected leadership are the ones who are supposed to then hear those things and take decisive action. And so I think there's a challenge when we start to think that one method is better than the other, because each one relies on the other to be able to have the will to be able to move, especially if you're fighting on behalf of people who don't have moneyed interests to be able to just drop into the system and say, that's how I speak, then you have to have voices involved. So what I say to people is, however you're going to show up, whether that's voting, and the voting has a big deal, you know, it's a big deal because it determines who gets in and who's making those decisions and how hard you have to fight for other things, whether or not people share your values and are willing to push in the direction you want them to go.
You know, there are accounts in political science literature that there's some sort of unilinear process, like there are voters and they tell politicians what to do and then they do it. Or there are communities, they tell electeds what to do, then they do it. And you're saying the process is a lot more dynamic.
Yes.
And these different bodies ricochet off of one another. And on the one hand, you have a direct impact by cleaning up your community. On the other hand, you also are voicing to electeds that this is important. And then electives might be then responding back to those communities and trying to develop greater considered judgment together, and then policies are enacted. So it's a very dynamic, not unilinear process. And you're encouraging people to find the space where they can participate in a way that doesn't overwhelm them, maybe. And I also think you're trying to sort of rattle those folks who create hierarchies around participation and evaluate some forms as more worthy than another, and kind of democratize and make the process more horizontal.
That's exactly it. It's so much more dynamic than just, hey, you're this and you talk to this. It's like you're part of this complex interplay that weaves back and forth. It's kind of like a wave in the ocean, right? You know, the tide goes out, the tide comes back in, and there are ways that each influence how we do things. I mean, you know, this isn't just a one-way street of like voters and non. It's all of these people who get involved in all of these different ways, and the nonprofits and the other organizations and the, you know, the specific political organizations and all of the work that happens around there to be able to, and the people who just show up and use media to tell their stories and to humanize mm-hmm. this process. You know, when I was coming of age, nobody talked about birth control and abortion publicly. And now people are coming out and telling their stories and making this so it's not some nameless, faceless medical procedure that happens, but these are real people's lives, and they're telling their stories of why this was an essential service for them and how damaging it would have been if they hadn't had access. And that's incredibly important. And that's all part of the political process.
I've got one question here about political participation, because we're talking so positively about it. And this has to do with the city and the way it's responding to homelessness. Mm-hmm. You know, recently there was a 5-4 decision to move the question of where sanctioned encampments are going to be located mm-hmm. to the city manager Howard Chan. And in effect, the decision that was made 5-4 was that the site planning locations are not going to be decided with a lot of public input or with city council input or with feedback from the community. And so I'm wondering, you know, why do you think the majority of council decided to kind of take those questions away from those spaces where there is possibility for greater input and to put the decision in the hands of a more insulated city manager? And what does that say about participation around this issue? And what are your thoughts on that decision?
I think this is a really big question, and it's one I've certainly grappled with because I think there is some complexity here. First, I certainly understand that I believe housing is a human right, and I understand that we are in a crisis when we have 10,000 people in Sacramento County who are currently, you know, experiencing homelessness. And so we have to first and foremost hold true to the fact that we have not acted, you know, fast enough, and we have allowed this crisis not only to get out of control, but to last for far too long. And so I understand where that, you know, the desire for expediency and the desire for decisive and immediate action is coming from. And just because we, you know, failure to prepare on their part does not constitute, you know, a need for reckless action on our part either. And so I am deeply concerned about the idea of handing over that responsibility to the city manager. On one hand, it does in some ways depoliticize, and I'm putting that in air quotes, you know, the decision, because it takes it away from an elected official and puts it in the hand of someone who's hired staff. On the other hand, it makes it so that person is shielded from the accountability of where those locations are. And I have to be really honest that I don't trust our city manager to make those decisions in a way that are equitable, because past behavior is the best, you know, predictor of future behavior. And, you know, at a time when 6 people died in one of the winter storms a few years ago, and the Sacramento Bee interviewed our city manager and asked him, you know, would he have opened up shelter had he known that was going to happen? Like, you know, hindsight being 2020, as we know it is. And he said, no, he wouldn't do anything different. And to me, that showed a real lack of human compassion for our neighbors who had died. And I also think that when it comes to, you know, thinking about equity on the lines of income and status, there is absolutely no way he would have uttered those words without a major rebellion had 6 people in the Asian and Pacific Islander community died that night, if 6 police officers had died that night, if 6 members of the city council had died that night, if 6 members of our business community. And so in that moment, in his callous disregard for human life, what he also showed me is all lives don't matter, which we always knew was the case. Like, we don't see equal value in certain lives. And so our unhoused community is being viewed as a throwaway. So no, I don't trust the person who could so callously say something like that to make decisions about where these places are going to be located. I also think this is layered on top of, you know, redlining and some of the other residential housing segregation that existed and persists because of patterns around affordability in our community. And so there are serious concerns by some of the council members that the locations that our city manager is going to choose are going to be concentrated in areas that get fewer investments, that are often ignored, and that have been historically disinvested.
There is some sort of perception, and I think you're really challenging this, that the city manager, because they're insulated, is somehow going to be more impartial. I mean, it's the argument for the Supreme Court too, right? Because they're insulated from politics, they become neutral or impartial or less instead of the other. And you're saying that is just patently not true. You bring to those positions whatever biases, whatever interests you have, and they bleed out into those decisions. And now there's going to be less accountability.
Yes.
Because of that insularity.
You know, I am always of the belief, and I say this repeatedly and people always chuckle, there's nothing that I've ever written, however much I like it, the first draft was the best draft. It has always benefited from some peer review. And so I also just, you know, even if our city manager was someone who I trusted very dearly, I don't think a decision like this should occur without some peer review and without some benefit of some other people who live in these communities. Our city manager only lives in one place. He can't live in, you know, in 12 different locations. And so being able to think about all of the aspects and be able to have some public input on that, I think is important. And I think as a public health professional, part of what I know is that these decisions are messy. Chaos is part of the process. And mm-hmm. so you're going to hear from people who don't all agree. There's not going to immediately be a consensus, and that's okay. It doesn't mean you don't act. What it means is you listen through those challenges and complaints to identify what people care about, because every piece of communication is somebody telling you what they care about. And we have to be thoughtful enough and skilled enough to hear that, and then to be able to include to the best of our ability those ideas into our decision making.
You sympathize with the idea that we need results and we want sites and we want them to be funded so that they provide water and social services
yes.
and a place to shower and a safe place to be, because without that, unhoused people are living without dignity. And so you want results, but having a city manager make those decisions on the one hand, as you said, is very expedient, but what you're looking for is considered results, good outcomes, and that requires deliberation and feedback and consultation to kind of raise, you know, to use a poli-sci term, the epistemic value, right? The,
yes.
The quality of those decisions.
Success has, you know, many parents, and failure is often, you know, abandoned. We sometimes say an orphan, right? Whatever the saying is. And so there's also this part of when you bring people into the process, they also then feel responsible and they help to push it along to success.
I'm personally engaged in collective bargaining right now at the CFA, and we've been doing mm-hmm. democratic bargaining. And because I've been participating in the very meetings with management, I feel like I have a greater stake.
Yep.
Being asked, being invited, being part of the process from the bottom up really helps facilitate a kind of ownership in a not in a possessive way, but a shared ownership.
Yes.
In the outcomes. And that is more likely to produce successful long-term outcomes after the decisions are made. Yeah.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
Another question I have here when we're focusing on participation is this requirement for participation around military equipment policies in the city. I know the state passed a law requiring public input, and I know there are public forums that have recently been held about the new increase in the military equipment budget or proposed increase. I know that there's a survey out there trying to get the police is putting out a survey trying to get folks to participate in reflecting on military equipment purchases. You know, when people participate in that, sometimes they come away feeling as if their input isn't being heard. Other folks are saying, no, this input is putting pressure upon the police and the city. I mean, where do you stand when it comes to the public being really involved and required to be involved around military equipment for the police?
Yeah, I think it is incredibly important, again, for the public to be involved in all of these decisions, including, you know, the military equipment. I attended one of the meetings, and what I found to be important was the fact that people showed up and they were really excited to share their ideas and really motivated to share, you know, what they thought about even the, you know, them acquiring these pieces of equipment and really wanting to better understand, what are you using them for? Why do you have so much? How much is it costing? How have they been used in the past? I think that was really, really helpful for those questions to be asked. And I thought they could have benefited from some public health, you know, help in terms of knowing their, and some communications help in terms of knowing their audience and being able to communicate well with the audience, because there was an initial, you know, overview of the legislation that led to the community input, and it was at way too technical a level. There was a lot of jargon and a lot of like political speak involved in it, and it was not accessible to community members in terms of what's happening and what's relevant to this meeting we're having now. And then even the presentation from the Sacramento Police Department was lacking in terms of its ability to be accessible to community members. because all of the presentation was entirely audio and there weren't really a lot of visual things to look at. And it's a lot of information to process. And so I thought it was in some ways a missed opportunity for what could have happened had there been a little more skilled facilitation of those meetings. And I think that, again, if you go into a meeting assuming that it's going to be this linear process where you share something, people give you feedback, and then you all go home agreeing on the next steps, then you were set up for failure to begin with. This is a chaotic process. You're going to hear a lot of things. People are going to, you know, sometimes blow up your meeting agenda. That's okay. You went in with a plan. That's all that matters. And now we're going to do something a little different to be responsive to the real-time needs. And I think mm-hmm. that more of that could have made this feel more productive in terms of the type of conversation that was being had.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm hearing you say that community involvement can be chaotic, yes. but you're really advocating for a way to ensure that it's structured so that everyone who shows up can gain from the experience because information is being offered in ways that are accessible to very diverse learners.
Yes.
So the chaos doesn't mean don't have any structure. Provide that structure so people can understand, so that they can learn, so that they can think more carefully, and then know that there will be still a very fluid process that goes on those terms, rather than excluding people from the get-go by making things too jargonized or making things too technical, or failing to provide different avenues for people to access information given their different learning styles. So there's yes. a kind of balance between structure mm-hmm. and chaos, fluidity and kind of discipline that is part of those spaces if they're serving their purposes well.
Yes. And people often see chaos as, you know, a kind of a pejorative term, or like as a negative, right? And I actually see, you know, there's an ordinal way of things happening, and then there's a way that is less predictable. And we often describe that as being chaotic. And that's not bad. It means that you're bringing a bunch of humans together and they're not going to behave as if they are machines. And it can often be in the short term unpredictable, but in the long term we often get to some level of agreement. And so if you can hold on to the fact that this is part of the process and that you're hearing these things and that's where you are, you'll get to the other side.
Let me turn the conversation to the Measure U Sales Tax Community Advisory Committee, which is more of a professional, I think, committee than a public forum. People who are progressives often show some skepticism about serving on these kinds of committees. You know, sometimes they say that it's the electives who set the agenda. The boat is never rocked if you serve on those committees, or it's the electeds who pick who sits on those commissions. And so it's only people who are allies to the electeds, or even if you're self-selecting, it's usually people with higher education, politically connected, wealthy folks who serve. Some folks don't see value in serving on those kinds of boards and bodies because they don't have decision-making power. Mm-hmm. Some people wonder, you know, if you serve, who are you really representing mm-hmm. As a member of that?
Yes.
And are you just providing cover for the electeds who are skirting accountability or looking to manufacture legitimacy? As someone who I know is a proponent and I share this commitment to serving on these committees, you know, how do you respond to all these criticisms of that service, and how could we overcome those critiques or respond to them?
I first and foremost agree with every single criticism that people have of them. They often are too close to the elected officials. They are an extension of, you know, their reach. They do tend to have people who are more politically connected and who are more educated and who are already represented by the process. And I think that is one of the downsides of, you know, how they are structured. And also, they also offer an opportunity, right? And in the same way that we can talk about every system having its pros and cons, this one certainly does. And so anybody who is skeptical has well-earned and well-deserved skepticism. And I say, you are absolutely right. No argument from me whatsoever. And I've also chosen to spend my limited life minutes serving in them in some ways. And, you know, and part of the reason that I have done that is because just because they're flawed doesn't mean they're not important. And so where I stand, and that doesn't mean, and I really want to hold on to this, that everybody is going to find value in them or that it's the right way for everybody to engage. That's why I really believe it takes an all hands approach, because some people are going to be like, you don't have any official decision-making authority. I have to play too nice with people who I don't want to play nice with. Right. I'm not sure. And then there are other people who can really come in and kind of take advantage of this. And in some ways use it to their advantage. And I hope that my tenure on Measure U was the latter and not the former. Because for me, I went in very clear that we didn't have institutional authority, but I was part of the group that argued for having a Measure U committee when we could see that Measure U was going to take place, because the previous version of the committee met like twice. And their only role was to be able to say, yep, no crimes happened with the spending of the money. Keep going. They were not an active body. And so we said we wanted there to be an oversight committee. And what we originally proposed was, I believe it was still a 15-member body, but we wanted more of them to be people who had specific expertise and lived experience. And then also looking at, so you don't have official statutory authority to make decisions about spending, but boy, can you use your pulpit to be able to amplify your message. So when things started going awry and we felt like we were doing the right thing, we went to the media and we said, here's what's happening. Come to our meeting, pay attention to this. And we were able to get in some ways front page, you know, coverage in the Sacramento Bee and the News and Review and in the Observer about some of the things that were happening on our committee and the reasons why people should get involved and how the promises of that, you know, that campaign when it was on the ballot were being broken and that there's an opportunity for us to get involved and push. And so what I look at is what would not have happened, what conversations we would not be having today were it not for some of those decisions.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that your service on the Measure U Sales Tax Community Advisory Committee offered you a platform to really advocate for where that sales tax money should go. Can you tell our audience, in what way were you critical of where Measure U money was going, particularly around the money going to the police?
Yes. So during the campaign, let me just give a little history of Measure U. In 2012, it was passed. It was a 0.5-cent sales tax that brought in about $50 million a year, and it was set to expire in 2019. And so in 2018, the mayor and council decided to put it on the ballot for renewal and to double the amount. So it would go from a 0.5-cent sales tax to a 1-cent sales and use tax and make it permanent. So it would no longer have an expiration date. And so during that campaign, a few promises were made that the money was going to go to inclusive economic development, that the money was going to go to homelessness and affordable housing, and that it was going to be used to support the arts community. Now, there were other promises that were made on the campaign trail. I like to joke and say that every group that was approached was told that $50 million, what could you do with $50 million for whatever your cause was, right? And there is absolutely some truth to that. But those are the main three that a lot of the messaging was, you know, was targeted toward. And so I'm going to say in good faith, let's pretend those are the main three. And so what was proposed was that the first 0.5-cent would be used to continue to fund the things it already was, which were basic city services. So a little bit went to parks, a little more went to fire, and then the lion's share went to the police department. But that the second 0.5-cent was going to be used for these other things. And there was a lot of like channeling the memory of Stephon Clark and our disinvested neighborhoods and, you know, communities that have been historically disenfranchised, and how important this money was going to be to bolster, you know, economic development of these communities and really operate outside of just business as usual. And then the second 0.5-cent also went to the police department, because they just continued to get raises and the money wasn't going where people wanted. And so there has been a lot of criticism of, you know, the rallying calls to take money away from police departments. But the truth of the matter here is it really isn't about taking money away. It was about just stopping the ongoing increases that were not spent in a way that our community wanted. Like, people in Sacramento want to be able to 24 hours a day be able to call and have somebody respond to mental health crises and homelessness issues. And we could have had that had we taken $7 million this year and invested it in making our Department of Community Response able to do 24-hour response. People want a place for our unhoused neighbors to be that's safe and that has dignity, and the human resources that we all need, like bathrooms, because using the bathroom multiple times a day is not an option. It's a necessity. And so we want that. And so I stood firm on these are broken promises that you're taking with our tax dollars that are disproportionately paid into by lower income folks, because all sales and use taxes are regressive, which means that you pay a greater portion of your income into them if you have less money. And so that means that it, from a moral standpoint, I think we have a greater duty to our lower income residents who are paying into this pot to serve their interests first. And what we did with the money was the exact opposite of that. And I've been talking a lot about this lately. You know, we had 2 years, a little more than 2 years, from the end of 2017 until the beginning of 2020, where we had no youth homicides in the city of Sacramento. None. None of our young people were buried because of gun violence deaths prematurely. And that happened because we had a complex network of violence prevention and intervention programs that were working collaboratively across the city to intervene and to prevent violence from happening. And right when the pandemic happened and all of the drivers of violence were going up, we were shutting down schools, we were increasing the unemployment rate by shutting down businesses, all these things that were necessary to be able to prevent the spread of a deadly infectious disease, but that we also know raise the risk of violence. Those programs came back to the city and said, we are going to need more resources to be able to pivot because this is new for us too. We've never had schools shut down and businesses shut down and all of these things, but we do know what happens when any of those variables are tinkered with, and it's that violence goes up. So if we want to keep this track record of no young people dying, we're going to need your help. And instead of giving some of the CARES Act money that came in and the ARPA money towards that, they kind of disbanded the network and shifted the money around. And so we no longer live in a city where young people haven't died for multiple years in a row from preventable deaths. And so when I look at public safety, I think of myself, you know, as a person who is firmly in support of funding public safety. But the difference between me and many other people who might use those same words are, I believe in prevention because I know none of us woke up this morning hoping to have a reason to call 911. And I believe in funding the things that work. So I want to be able to see our money go to the things that evidence shows works, that the city shows works, and that are cost effective and that are going to save lives. And that's a definition of public safety that I can get behind.
You mentioned we don't always have to reinvent the wheel and come up with something new. If we have existing programs or even past programs that there is data and evidence to show that they work, they just need to be funded and supported and expanded and leaned into. So what do you think is leading so many people to look for the new shiny object rather than be data driven and say, this is evidence-based, it's worked for us, let's just continue it or expand it? Like what's happening to explain why folks aren't doing what you advise?
It does seem nonsensical to me. The only thing I can figure out is that nobody wants to share credit with other people. And so if it's not, so everybody has to come up with their own brand new idea for how they're going to solve this problem. And I am coming, you know, at all of these things with the approach of like, people way smarter and way not more knowledgeable than me have answers. My job is to listen to them, to look at their answers, and then to elevate them and to offer them as, you know, options. I mean, and so we have to find ways to collaborate, even if we can't be your boss. And that's a great way for cities to be able to run, is to be able to collaborate and find mutual interests and to come up with approaches to doing things together that are going to benefit multiple things without having to come along and completely change who's responsible.
Well, you're really talking about, at least what I hear, is a new vision of leadership, a leadership that's very collaborative in nature, a leadership that's sort of humble. If there are experts, you can listen to their advice and move it forward. So can you talk, you know, a little bit about your vision of leadership, especially because you're running for mayor in a system where we don't have strong mayor, where we have city council members, where there's a board of supervisors, there's the state, there's the community, there are neighborhoods. Like, how do you imagine leadership in the mayoral position or what is the right kind of leadership for our mayor in Sacramento?
So I always reject the frame of, you know, the limitations of the seat, because I also think that there are lots of ways the seat can be used that we haven't seen necessarily in recent times. One of them is, of course, narrative change, right? People want to know what the mayor thinks on issues, and you have the opportunity to frame issues. And I use the word framing because when you put a picture in a frame, you change how people see it. Right? That is the entire intention behind a frame. And so I think there is a leadership role in changing how people see the city's function and how people see some of the challenges that our city is facing. And I think that is a great role for our mayor to play. But I think the other part of it is that rather than strong versus weak mayor, it's a collaborative mayor. And so it requires that you sit down and actually set some priorities, something that we have not seen our city do in so many years. Now, obviously, there will be new pieces of legislation that are passed along the way and new policies implemented. But step one has to be, what overall are we working on so our staff can fit into that process and our community members and our organizations and everyone can fit into what we've said is important and what we're going to work on? And what are our outcomes and deliverables for those, so we can know if we've been successful, we can know how much money we want to invest based on what we're trying to do. And so that's what I see as leadership, is that the mayor sets the council agenda, structures the meetings, and decides how the business gets done. That's an incredibly powerful role. And so instead of going in saying, oh, well, you can't make unilateral decisions, well, good. Because as I've talked about before, part of the challenge in making unilateral decisions is that you are by yourself. And so, you know, the kind of community saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Fast is not bad. Far is not bad, but they're different goals. And I think our city wants to go far. And so I think being able to get four other people on board for a vision and push that vision forward is incredibly important to making sure that our city has some backing to the things that we decide to do. And we're not just passing policy willy-nilly and not having any thoughtfulness into the implementation of it.
In poli-sci books, folks often talk about the three faces of power. And one face is really the decision-making power. But the two other faces, one is agenda setting, like you were saying. I mean, deciding what's on and not on the agenda, what will be decided upon and what won't be decided upon, is tremendous power. And the third form, the third face, is about framing. It's about the discourse and establishing what the discourse around a particular issue is and what meaning it has, how it makes sense, what the options are. It's a kind of power that happens within culture, and it's not always so visibly seen and understood, but it's tremendous power. So those forms of power could really facilitate all kinds of progressive politics. And if we can harness our collective power, we can go much longer and farther than if we go it alone. Yeah. Okay. One final question. This has really been amazing, and I've learned so much. The Building Justice podcast originates from Sac State, and so many of our students are underprivileged, underserved, minoritized. Many, 10% of the CSU students are housing insecure. Many of them are working two jobs, driving long distances to come to campus.
Yes.
If you could pull them aside as an activist and also as a woman of color, and could you, what would you tell them about the value of their political engagement, and how could you mentor them? And if they talk to you about the barriers they face, like, how would you respond?
I would first and foremost say that you are the expert at your own lived experience. And so no one can tell your story the way that you can tell your story. And that means that in every space, and this is a really valuable lesson I've learned from public health, that in every space, it's not just the people who have formal education who are experts in things, but it's also people who have the experience. And that experience sometimes comes from living, and sometimes comes from studying. And we value expertise in all the forms that it comes in. And so you have some expertise, and you being able to couple that with finding your voice and sharing that voice can really move people. Because anytime legislation is up in our state house or everywhere else, people want to hear from the people most impacted. They don't always seek out those voices, but that is often the most powerful testimony. So finding ways to be able to elevate your voice and to be able to be a part of the change that you'd like to see is incredibly important. And if you're feeling downtrodden, if you're feeling demoralized, if you're feeling like nothing is going to get better, I strongly urge you to read some historical narratives about people who've been in the same position. Because one of the things I find most comforting in life is recognizing that there are almost 8 billion people on this planet and almost nothing about our experience is unique. We are just all living it in a slightly different way, but throughout history and also currently, any experience you're having, it's likely very relatable to probably no fewer than 100,000 people somewhere on the planet. And the more that we come together and collaborate, the better it is for our souls and our beings. And so finding your people, being able to come together with them, being able to love on them, being able to organize with them, being able to support and cry and grieve and have your human experience with some other people is so important. And seek out those people because they are out there. And just because the first people you find aren't your people doesn't mean they don't exist.
Is there anything you want to leave with the audience before we close? It's been a real pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. I am immensely grateful for the opportunity to serve the city of Sacramento in so many different ways. And I see this is just but another opportunity to offer, you know, my service. And I am really, you know, hopeful and optimistic about the opportunity to be able to continue to serve in this capacity. But regardless, Sacramento is my home. It is a really rich and wonderful community. And I am really honored to have been on the show and to be able to have an opportunity to just share some thoughts on things and to, you know, reflect some of the wisdom that has been imparted on me over the years. I am incredibly grateful to the people of Sacramento. And so I am looking forward to what we're going to do next. So let's go get it.
That sounds great. We are going to do great things together. Thank you so much, Dr. Flo, for being on the Building Justice podcast. And with that, everyone, I'm going to close by saying thanks for listening. We hope our ongoing conversations spark understandings, empathies, and motivation to join the struggle for a better future for all. And you just listened to the Building Justice podcast. The information contained in the podcast, including its title and description, represent the views and opinions of the hosts and the guests and don't necessarily represent the views or opinions of Sac State, Chris J, or the Building Justice podcast committee. Take care. Thanks. All the penalties and the rewards based on the actions. Now, time for Building Justice. Building Justice.